The Healthy Indiana Plan lives on. Is it the victory the governor says it is? Luke Messer questions John Kerry on Syria, a report on the A2F grading system, and a scooter summit. That plus Mike Pence to Japan, Blue 2, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 6,
2013. Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
AT&T, connecting Hoosiers with the world for more than 130 years. Investing to build communication networks to help Indiana businesses and consumers succeed in a global economy. AT&T, rethink possible.
This week, the governor announced federal approval for continuation of the Healthy Indiana Plan, or HIP, until the end of 2014. Mike Pence says the program will also expand slightly. It provides health care for low-income Hoosiers who can't otherwise get insurance. The governor, meantime, made it clear that he remains opposed to an expansion of Medicaid that is possible under the Affordable Care Act.
I believe that securing the waiver to continue the Healthy Indiana Plan is a victory for Hoosiers enrolled in this innovative program.
He is dead wrong. What we're seeing today is something being trumpeted as a success when in essence it is a complete failure.
Who are the winners and losers in the decision to preserve HIP? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, there is some good news here, right?
Well, yeah, the 34,000 people that are on this are not going to be cut off. I guess that's good news.
Well, some will be.
But
some of them will be because they're changing the income guidelines.
Changing the income guidelines. They have a 50-some-odd thousand-person waiting list, and we're leaving, between 350 and 400,000 people uninsured. And we're leaving them uninsured with a policy that's much better than what we're offering under the Healthy Indiana program. I find it really ironic that this pro-life governor, and he toots himself as being pro-life and pro-family, the Healthy Indiana program does not cover pregnancy, okay? It doesn't cover pregnancy. So it is an inferior plan, it's at higher cost, and we're leaving hundreds of thousands of Hoosiers uninsured. So that's a loss for the state.
The governor has said all along that he would consider expanding Medicaid if it could be done through the HIP program. This
right.
expansion applies to about 8,000 people, where a Medicaid expansion could apply to over 300,000.
Well, and certainly one of the other parts of that waiver that HHS did not address was the expansion of the Healthy Indiana Plan. And
the Healthy Indiana plan is paid for with cigarette tax money, and there isn't enough cigarette tax money to go beyond the $45,000 they've approved.
Well, where's the long-term money for the plan that the president's proposed?
They're picking up the entire cost initially.
Well, and where does that money come from? That money is our money.
It comes from federal taxes. Well, the point is, it's going to go to the other 49 states.
It isn't picked up long term. It's only a 3-year guarantee.
And then it goes to 10%.
But what you're saying is,
who picks up the cost now for emergency room visits?
What you're saying is the governor's philosophical objection to Obamacare applies even if HIP stays.
What I'm saying is the Healthy Indiana plan's been wildly successful. People like it. It's a similar program to what state employees receive today. It's consumer-driven. Put those decisions in the hands of consumers and let them participate in their health care decision.
You're telling me state employees have pregnancy that is not covered?
State employees have a consumer-driven health care plan.
Do state employees' pregnancies get covered?
State employees have a consumer-driven health care plan. And that's what we're talking about, putting those decisions in the hands of consumers.
John, the governor says he will continue to negotiate, with the federal government, but it doesn't seem like things will change much between the now and the end of 2014.
Probably not. And there's certainly they found some common ground, and the governor was pointed out during the remarks he made in announcing this, the what he described as the good faith efforts on both sides, which there's clearly some attempt here to play nice on both sides of the table. But you look at the plan as it's structured now, and unless there are some more significant tweaks in terms of how it's structured with caps, I think there are, aren't there lifetime caps built in there now, and copays and things such as pregnancy and maybe some of the
health savings
ophthalmology savings care accounts. And other sorts of, there are certain things in there that are non-starters long-term, as I understand it, for the federal government, which ultimately will say whether, but where this may head, Jim, is if it morphs to address these things so that the cap, and I'm not saying the administration necessarily here would be willing to do that, but if the caps come off, if more of these types of coverage areas were included, and in return for the agreement to let us continue to call it the Healthy Indiana Plan, is the Medicaid expansion.
Who's going to finance it?
Well,
it's a hypothetical.
But
hypothetical,
then at least you can
best.
Have a political victory. I'm saying in political terms, that might be easier to stomach for the state administration.
John Kitzenberger, did the federal government silence a critic this week?
In the governor? Well, no. And I think the argument's far from over. He may be calling this a victory for people who are under the plan, and that may be the truth. But the reality is what Ann describes in terms of the number of people who are not going to get any kind of coverage and who could get coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Now, I understand the concern about long-term funding, but this plan goes out through 2020, where after 2017, I believe 2018, 2019, 2020, it's 90% funded by the federal government. And I think that Ann also makes a good point about the fact that the money's going to be spent, period. And it's Indiana's choice whether or not to participate in that plan and allow those other Hoosiers to have coverage under Medicaid that they otherwise won't have. So this does not protect providers in Indiana who will continue to have to provide service and not be reimbursed because these people don't have coverage. It does not help the people who are currently without insurance or won't have insurance going forward. It complicates the insurance exchange, which already the state has said is going to follow the federal exchange, and we don't know what that's going to look like at this point. So the governor's made a philosophical stand, and I understand that, but it is not a victory for people who need insurance in Indiana.
And it's going to be very hard to explain to people around the periphery, for example, if you're in the Louisville market or the Cincinnati market or the Chicago market, and you're being bombarded with TV ads about how to sign up and how to participate, and you're sitting there renting an apartment in, say, New Albany or Evansville or someplace, and you say, wait a second, if I move across the river, I get health care coverage, which for some families can be as much as $1,000 a month. And if I live in Indiana, I don't get it. What's wrong with this picture? Answer, Mike Pence.
Well, did the governor want to expand Medicaid, or did he just want to keep HIP alive?
I think keeping HIP alive and the options that are available with it and expanding the Medicaid program under HIP is exactly what he wants to do. A homegrown program that addresses the needs of health care and puts decisions in people's hands.
Well, that's
but
why
again,
you have an
if you
exchange.
Just but if you just look at the numbers here, we're talking about the decision this week means health care for an additional 8,000 people, where an expansion of Medicaid would be more than 300,000. Right?
But there was an expansion that was discussed in that plan that was not addressed by HHS
and
the one-year waiver that they provided this week.
This is all about appealing to the Tea Party. That's all that's about. It's not about health care. And on top of that, the Healthy Indiana program doesn't meet the needs of Hoosiers.
It was a bipartisan plan when it was originally adopted.
One thing it was better than nothing, but it's not better than Obamacare.
But it wasn't an option. It wasn't an alternative to an expansion of Medicaid at that point.
No,
that's correct.
Quickly.
Because of the concern about long-term funding, 100% now, and then it goes to 90%, but will it really be 90%? Some states have looked at circuit breaker legislation where basically written into it is, we'll do it as long as there's 90% federal funding.
Right.
If that stops, guess what? We're out. So that hasn't gotten some attention in other states. Not so much here, but maybe that will come to the fore.
You also have to look at the cost. It's not as if there's no health care costs associated with having no insurance. The hospitals are bearing it right now.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Indiana expand Medicaid coverage? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C, let's see if it works in other states first. Last week's question was, should Governor Mike Pence run for president? 15% said yes, it's his best opportunity. 40% said no, he should run for re-election. 46% said it's too early to decide. That's 45%. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana GOP Congressman Luke Messer is on one of the key committees considering a resolution to attack Syria. John Kerry appeared alongside Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to make the case for an attack. Luke Messer waited 4 hours for the opportunity to speak, and when he did, he told the Secretary of State that he was convinced of the need to use force.
The facts as I see them are that chemical weapons were used, innocent children were gassed. Clearly, our allies like Israel in the region believe action is needed. Clearly, evil dictators in Iran, North Korea, and elsewhere are watching.
Messer made his remarks after a Senate committee had already voted to approve an attack designed to punish Syrian President Bashar Assad. The Indiana congressman gave the representatives of the Obama administration something of a lecture.
The president and the three of you as a team and others have a lot of work to do to explain the necessity for this action with the American people.
And that led to Messer's only question.
What more can be done to further communicate with the American people? For example, will the president make a speech from the Oval Office to the American people in one of the coming evenings?
I have no doubt the president will.
And we now know that the president will make an address on Tuesday evening. Tim Berry, will most of the Indiana delegation follow Messer's lead?
You know, I don't know about that. I will say this. I think most of us agree that the president's a pretty good communicator most of the time. But on this issue, I think he's failed. First he said he authorized an attack. Then he said he's going to pitch it at Congress. And he's yet to really define to the American people why and how. And I think that's the question that's outstanding.
But you can't show all your cards.
No,
either.
No. And I think we'll know an awful lot more next week when the address occurs.
The American people are skeptical, and rightly so, because of what happened with the run-up to Iraq. And I think that the administration and Congress, I think it's a good thing that's being vetted by Congress. And hopefully the American public will get a full story so that we can have full confidence whatever the decision is made.
Jackie Walorski said today that she can't vote for this. So I think it's interesting how both Republicans and Democrats are split on this.
It is. I looked at some of the early subjective analyses about who's in what camp, and it really does split all over the board in ways that you don't see very often with other issues. One thing Luke Messer makes a point here, even though he's supportive of the action, I think he makes a valid point that if now that the president has turned to Congress for this seal of approval, if he doesn't get it, Luke Messer points out there may be a real constitutional question that arises if the president, after doing this, decided to go forward.
I don't think he's going to do that. So.
Yeah. All right. A bipartisan review of A2F school grading was finished this week. The system came under fire as a result of a scandal involving former state school superintendent Tony Bennett. Democrat John Grew and Republican Bill Sheldrake were appointed by legislative leaders to conduct the review. And the results were just made public. In the report, the two men say that Bennett's actions in changing grades for the Crystal House Academy were plausible. Bennett and a spokesman for Bennett, who was at the State House, immediately said that Bennett is vindicated. John Ketzenberger, is Tony Bennett vindicated?
No, he's not. And the reason why, I mean, I talked with the people who did the report afterwards, and they made clear that that wasn't their goal here. It wasn't to vindicate anybody. They looked at the issue. And I think if you look at the report, you read the report, they weren't able to say that Tony Bennett acted in a way that was inappropriate, but the program itself was so poorly implemented that they had these problems. And these problems existed because the administration, the Department of Education Administration, failed to implement this plan correctly. So they did not vindicate anyone in this.
Legislative leaders say that they didn't see anything nefarious as a result of what's in the report. They weren't endorsing Tony Bennett's actions.
No, I think a lot of people, as with, these aren't statistics per se, but as is often the case with statistics, you can read into it what you want to read. And I saw some of the statements that were being released this afternoon by the chamber, which saw something that it liked in terms of dealing more with individual progress reports or students' progress as opposed to standardized test scores. Democratic Party saw something, Republican Party. So it's in the eye of the beholder. But it's what this is, it seems to me, is a commercial for transparency. Mm-hmm. Again, if the Department of Education had said, you know, we got a problem. The rule said should do this from the State Board of Education,
right,
and there was a mistake made in terms of testing caps that was put into the computer program, that's about all technical I want to get about it. If you said that, and then those 165 schools were bumped up accordingly, I think you would have avoided this whole problem.
Well, so I think what we got from the report today is that Tony Bennett didn't do anything illegal, but he didn't handle this well.
Well, you know, Tony Bennett certainly was a lightning rod, but I think it's time to stop the Bennett bashing, and let's get beyond the election here. I think the report said that what was done was appropriate and was plausible, consistently applied across the board, not just to one school, but to multiple programs.
Well, as it turns out, to 660 schools.
And did they implement it as well as they probably could have?
No.
I think they admitted no, they didn't. But I think that they said that everything was applied consistently and was the reaction of what should have been done.
Well, there's now going to be a 17-member review panel. Look at what should be done going forward. Are we done with what happened in the past?
Well, I don't know that we're done with what happened in the past, because it points out the problems and the subjectivity of this. What he did here is he wanted a particular result, and he played with it to get that result. Now, he was smart enough to appoint it to do it consistently across the board, but it's pretty clear from the emails that he didn't want the result that he got.
Actually, I don't
think
it is.
And as a result of that, he went ahead and changed it all, and that part was smart, because that does make it at least seem that there's a, quote, plausible explanation.
Look, the report was much needed and much welcome, because it does explain what went on. And the problem came when they looked at the Crystal House result and used that as a benchmark. They should never have used that as a benchmark. That's the problem. I'm not sure that there was the hanky-panky.
Right.
Emails do look pretty damning.
They do look pretty bad.
But by using schools as a benchmark, you brought in subjective.
That's exactly right. That's the
evidence,
and that's
into
what
an objective.
That's right.
Process.
The report points that out, and if we use this report going forward, we shouldn't have this problem next time.
I think that's what Glenda Ritz is trying to do, is to make it as objective as possible.
Although she wouldn't,
and transparent.
She wouldn't make a public statement with regard
to the
report.
I don't think she should.
All right. Scooter crashes caused 24 fatalities in Indiana last year, and this week, organizers of a scooter summit said that's too many. Half a dozen lawmakers, law enforcement officers from throughout the state, and representatives of Abate were at the summit. Abate is a group that promotes education for motorcycle riders and usually discourages more laws. However, its leaders say that scooters have so little regulation that nobody even knows how many are on the road.
Our goal is to get the players involved, if you will, and identify what the issues might be so we can try to strike some compromises before we get into the session of the General Assembly. Maybe head off some of those challenges and have a chance of being more successful.
Jay Jackson of Abate there. John Schwanis, do scooters belong on the road?
I suppose they have a place on the road, but maybe the question is, under what guidelines or with what caveats do you need to have license plates and registration and proof of insurance, and should age... We do have some requirements in Indiana. I think you have to be 15, and then you have to wear protective headgear if you're under 18. But I didn't even, frankly, know anything about this until the summit came up, and I think a lot of people presume they are licensed in some way.
I think there's been the legislature, it appears to me, has intentionally turned its head.
Right.
And these are what, in some circles, commonly known as DUI rides. When you lose your driver's license and you can't otherwise drive a car, you go get a scooter.
Or a golf cart. I think that... You know, there is a safety issue here. And I think that there should be some bare minimum regulations applied so that you can be common sense about these things.
It is a DUI ride, and because we have no public transportation system to speak of. But the bigger problem comes in. Last General Assembly session, they passed legislation allowing you to track uninsured motorists easier. Okay? Well, guess what's not being implemented? Anything regarding that, because you're not allowed to have any new regulations. So even if they went tomorrow and passed something in the legislature to regulate scooters, it can't happen because of the directive from the governor.
Will the legislature do anything now?
Yeah, Representative Crouch has been working on this. And
Suzanne Crouch, Republican, Evansville.
Right, and I think she'll continue to move forward. I think it's an issue in communities across the state, and I think they're trying to address it.
Well, it will continue to be a problem unless no regulation is lifted. So,
the governor departed this week on his first foreign trade mission. Mike Pence is headed to Japan with a delegation of 40 that includes First Lady Karen Pence. They will visit with leaders of 20 Japanese countries. Among those on the trip are Commerce Secretary Victor Smith, who's been to Japan 22 times as an executive in private industry, and Jim Schellinger, a Democrat who ran for governor in 2008.
I wanted to make a statement that that Japan would be our first trip. Japan is unquestionably our most important bilateral trading partner. And I think making the statement that we're going to Japan and only to Japan is an important statement for our administration to make.
And Delaney, does that seem like an intelligent approach?
I think it's fine. Can't do any harm. It's nice for him to have a family vacation. He's not doing much back here. He might as well go.
I've seen the itinerary. It doesn't look like a vacation.
Well, the family's going along on it, so that's nice.
His daughter is going in family.
And his expense. Wife.
His wife. Two kids are going to college.
Mm-hmm. A half family vacation.
You know, 45,000 families in the state of Indiana are employed by businesses headquartered in Japan. I remember when Evan Bayh didn't want those employers in the state of Indiana. I think it's an important aspect to thank them for their investment in the state and their reinvestment in the state.
And many of them are in the automobile industry when Mike Pence didn't support the bailout, which is now contributing to manufacturing.
And Subaru is expanding in Lafayette, mm-hmm. and it's an appropriate time to thank them for that investment.
As the governor departed, he seemed to try to keep expectations low for this visit. He says mostly what he's doing is maintaining relationships. I mean, that's a good idea, too, isn't it?
In any situation like that, you want to make sure that the expectations are low, because ideally you're going to come back with some good news, either about expansion or maybe even a company that doesn't have a presence in Indiana now announcing that it would. Why would you set yourself up for, show me the politician who says, I'm going to come back with a dozen commitments and it's a failure, and it's a failure if I don't do it.
One-term
I think
that's, governor.
That's the newsworthy thing if we see that.
I hope that this is a practice run, that he's getting his chops in the international arena so that he can go to places where we need to cultivate new business like China and Korea and in other places around the world, because if there hadn't been that heavy lifting done in the late 70s and early 80s, we wouldn't have those 250 Japanese companies in Indiana. We need to move to the next generation.
Bob Orr started foreign trade missions to Asia, and Mitch Daniels really kind of stepped it up, and I thought it was interesting.
It took him forever to get to China, though.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, though, that Mike Pence said that he talked to Mitch Daniels on the phone. He hasn't shared that in other circumstances to get ready for this trip. I mean, he seems to be taking this seriously, even if
can't poke a little fun, for goodness sake. And he isn't doing much in Indiana, and I do hope it results in some jobs. And certainly in the automotive area, it ought to, because it's booming here thanks to the bailout Obama arranged.
He's going to promote in Japan a state that lives within its means, a state that's reduced taxes. I think he is doing some things here in Indiana.
A state whose educational system is sinking.
Finally, it's a blue week at Butler University as the campus remembers Blue 2. The school's bulldog mascot is the subject of a memorial at Atherton Student Union. It includes a painted portrait of Blue 2, along with a call for donations to help pay for and build a special memorial honoring all Butler mascots. Blue became known as America's dog to some people in 2010 and 11 when the Butler men's basketball team played for the NCAA National Championship.
Butler's just such a big family, and he was part of the family, and everybody loved him. I never got to meet him personally, but just getting to see him run around at basketball games and everything, it was really great just to know he was there as a part of the family.
Butler student Shannon Reed, there, Tim Berry, is that going a little overboard for a dog?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I think we could all learn a lot from Butler Blue 2 on social media. He became beloved across the country and was a great ambassador for the school, this city, and quite frankly, the state of Indiana and our beloved basketball in the state.
Don't forget the tribute that Tim Berry's paying to him with the blue shoes he's wearing if you get a wide shot at the close of the blue shoes. So
I think
that's part of this.
Right? I just
right.
hope there's no truth to the rumor that he died of a broken heart because Brad Stevens left.
Yeah, me too. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and Jack Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast or starting Monday. You can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
AT&T, connecting Hoosiers with the world for more than 130 years. Investing to build communication networks to help Indiana businesses and consumers succeed in a global economy. AT&T, rethink possible.